what I'm going to claim essentially that what is new in degrowth is not interesting, which is this idea of stopping growth all across the world. And what is interesting in degrowth is not new. A lot of the policy proposals that are there have been endorsed for many times.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of In Plain English. I am your host, Jamie Moffa, and today we are going to be talking about degrowth. Specifically, we're going to be talking about the paper, The Environment and Directed Technical Change by Darren Acemoglu et al. We will also be talking about a more colloquial and less technical collection of blog posts about degrowth featuring anti-degrowth economist Branko Milanović and pro-degrowth, I think, environmental economist Jason Hickel. So, with all that out of the way, our expert for this episode is Alejandro González. Can you introduce yourself?
Thank you very much, Jamie, for those kind words. I'm Alejandro González. I'm a third-year PhD student at the University of Washington, St. Louis. I am formerly from Chile in South America. I've been in the United States for 4 years. And my topics of research are on growth and business cycles. I am not an expert on environmental economics or degrowth in any way or form, but the broad policy implications that degrowth has made me interested on this topic. And because I worry a lot about growth, if we shouldn't have any growth in the first place, then my whole career is wrong. So that's why I think it was kind of important to address this.
This is perhaps your conflict of interest statement. And then our guests for this episode are William Lima and Evelyn Fraser. So welcome to the podcast. And can you each introduce yourself?
Sure. I'll go first. I'm William Lima. I have a PhD in mathematics. I studied pure mathematics. I don't know that much about economics, but I can kind of understand the math. And I'm originally from Brazil, from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. And I've been here in St. Louis, I believe, for like almost 3 years. And I was really interested in this topic because I'm really interested in sort of consumerism and its impact on the individual. And degrowth sort of tackles that a little bit on that side, on the side of the individual as well.
I'm Evelyn Fraser. I am a friend of Jamie's. I am a run-of-the-mill accountant student. And I have a hobby interest in learning about economics. And I just really love the concept of trying to figure out how to get a massive group of very complex humans to, you know, cooperate and work together, or, you know, to devise a system that makes it so that we can all have, you know, a quality of life, even though we're all so different and we have different goals and values and things like that. I really think that that's a very interesting and complex puzzle. And I love thinking about that and learning about it. So I am very excited to be somebody who does not know what they're talking about on this podcast.
Absolutely. I think this is going to be a great discussion. I am so excited for it. And I think that it would maybe help to frame the discussion. So if Alejandro, you could talk about, like, zooming way out before we get into the weeds, like, what is the central issue? Like, why are we talking about degrowth? Why have some people proposed it? What is, like, the rationale behind doing this?
Sure. As its name implies, degrowth, or what we will be calling degrowth, and I explain why so we're going to designate a specific interpretation of it, is a set of specific policy ideas that come in either a strong or a weak form. On its strong form is the idea that we should stop economic growth all across the globe right now. And economic growth means, in practical terms, an increase in the amount of GDP per capita that the world is experiencing, right? For those of you who don't know, GDP, gross domestic product, is a measure of all the goods and services that are trading that the economy produces every single year. All right. So when you see when in the newspapers discussion of growth went up or down, they're talking about this flow of productions and service went up or down. So that's the strong version of degrowth. We stopped GDP growth all across the globe immediately. And the weak version of degrowth is we recognize, and we're going to get into the weeds of this later, that in the global south or in many poor and developing countries, standards of living are so low that they should be allowed to catch up to the level of GDP that in Western countries is already established. And hence, it should be developed countries, meaning the United States, Canada, Western Europe, Japan, right? That should stop growing, and we should allow poor countries to catch up to the level of developed economies. All right. So that's what we're going to be calling degrowth. All right. So the reason why I said that's what we're going to be calling degrowth is because degrowth is at the present moment not endorsed by any major political party in the world, and hence it lives in the blogosphere, right? Or online and small groups of activists and certain environmental economists, and the way in which they use the term degrowth varies a lot, and we're going to see this, and this is going to be one of my lines of attack to degrowth, and based on the blog that we discussed, right? So what I would and we will see in our discussion that sometimes people include other things in degrowth that have been a staple of standard socialist policies for many, many years. For example, a reduction in working hours, or for example, socially planifying certain and important sectors like health, right, or education, as opposed to targeting yachts and, you know, jewelry, right? So that is not new. That has been on the social, that has been, if you open up literally the Gotha program, the first socially program written ever at the beginning of the 19th century, you know, those policies are there. So what I'm going to claim essentially that what is new in degrowth is not interesting, which is this idea of stopping growth all across the world. And what is interesting in degrowth is not new. So a lot of the policy proposals that are there have been endorsed for many times.
Now I was going to ask, like, or I guess maybe bring in the why. So like, it may seem obvious, but my understanding is that why this is being proposed is that we are rapidly approaching climate catastrophe, and at our current levels of consumption and our current levels of fossil fuel use, et cetera, this is not sustainable for the global environment. And so something must be done to sort of course correct. And one proposal is degrowth that has gained some traction in the left recently.
The case I'm going to make against degrowth is that catching on your point is that degrowth makes a wrong diagnostic, right? So the necessary of like why we need degrowth is either based on one or two arguments. One is it's a catchphrase, a slogan that says infinite growth on finite resources is not possible. So that's like something that people throw around a lot. And then this is a very old idea, by the way. And we can talk about its intellectual origins of its idea. It dates back to Thomas Malthus, an economist in the 19th century, who's made the same version of this argument with land. And it's been, you know, so far disproved. And then the other version of the argument is what you said, Jamie, which is we are approaching very, very rapidly climate catastrophe. And then if we don't stop growing, we will die in a generation or two, right? So I think both versions of this argument are incorrect. And I think that's where we bring in the Acemoglu paper that we discussed. However, besides that wrong diagnostic, what I'm going to argue is that the policy consequences of the policy proposals of degrowth, specifically stopping degrowth, would have disastrous consequences for the vast majority of workers in the world. So it would be, I would argue that degrowth would be the most anti-worker policy that has ever lived in the circle of the left, right? It would make millions of workers around the world miserable. I'm going to argue that the policy proposals, on top of being harmful for workers, are unfeasible. There's no set of technical or policy instruments that we know of that will allow us to implement them. So even if we say, you know what, if the diagnostic is correct, these policy consequences wouldn't be disastrous, I'm just going to argue that the humankind has not developed any policy instruments to implement something like degrowth. We would need a socialist revolution and then some to try to implement degrowth. So, and then finally, I'm going to argue that these policy proposals are going to be impossible to implement because they wouldn't find any political support. So that's going to be my case against degrowth. It makes a wrong diagnostic. It makes policy proposals that are dangerous to workers around the world. It makes policy proposals that are unfeasible. And even if none of that were true, it's going to be impossible. They would be impossible to find political support. And that's, I think, the blog exchange between Branco and Heckschel touches on those last three points, right? And touches on some of those issues, which I thought would be good background material for us to read.
One of my initial questions has actually already been answered. You know, when I'm reading about this stuff, I'm I'm trying to figure out whether the word degrowth is being used as just purely a vocabulary word, a basic concept that we're all talking about and what it means for each person who's discussing it is different, or if this is like an economic set of ideas and conclusions from it. So that question was answered. That gives me some context for processing this.
I'd just like to say that I kind of agree with everything that Alejandro said. I think, you know, especially the part where he said that a lot of the ideas of degrowth already exist. They're already like socialist ideas. And I think that's what, you know, why it can gain like, have, you know, gain some traction amongst like some more leftist circles. Maybe that's why I was so interested in it to begin with. Like, yeah, I agree with that. Maybe the GDP isn't a measure of how well a country's doing. Maybe we should switch to some other way of measuring, you know, well-being and stuff like that. But there was also a sense of it being very utopian, right? Incredibly utopian. Like, you're just going to halt the GDP. Good luck. You know, it seems like absolutely impossible, right? That, you know, you're going to be able to just convince everyone in the world to do that.
I mean, I have done more homework for this episode than I think I've done for any episode where I wasn't the one presenting. I listened to several different podcasts, three different podcasts featuring proponents of degrowth. And a thing they all seem to agree on is that this cannot work in a capitalist society. Like, you simply cannot have capitalism without growth, which is more of an argument, like Alejandro said, for a socialist revolution than it is for, you know, we can kind of, you know, after we do socialism, we can think about the day after and how we plan this. And I honestly I still think that some of the ideas in degrowth are interesting to think about as like policy proposals for a socialist future. But I did see that there was agreement, at least among the small sample size that I found, that this was not workable under capitalism.
I also this just occurred to me right now that it seems like even from like a game theory perspective, right? If one country adopts degrowth and anyone else doesn't, they might be kind of screwed, right? You know, it's just it needs everyone to agree. It's like it doesn't seem like it's a Nash equilibrium. You get me? One person just deviates and they just get you know, stomped on by everyone else. So it needs everyone to coordinate it at the same time. And yeah, okay, we'll do it. And then suddenly, I don't know, China decides to do otherwise and invades everyone. I don't know.
I do have a question for Alejandro, though. You said that like the two kind of diagnoses that degrowth is founded on is wrong. And one is that you can't have like endless growth on a finite planet, which you can kind of get into the like counter arguments to that. The one that I'm more interested in that you like the diagnosis that you said is also wrong was that like we are headed towards climate catastrophe. And my understanding is that perhaps like can you explain, I guess, why that diagnosis is wrong?
Let me be very precise by what I mean, so I don't get accused of being a climate denier. I am not saying, okay, so there's two claims, right? One is if humanity doesn't do anything different from what we're doing right now, at some unspecified point in the future, we're gonna have a climate catastrophe. Okay, so I think I am sympathetic to that claim, and obviously I'm an economist, I'm not a climate scientist, but based on my reading of the evidence and what I've talked with our climate scientists, I think that, well, it is incredibly difficult to forecast what will happen in the past future. But I do think that a claim that I would say received like broad consensus is that climate change will have very costly consequences, at least in the long run, where the long run is, you know, hundreds of years. Okay, so I think that the claim of the growers is that climate extinction is right about the corner. It's not that climate change, it's not only that there might be catastrophic consequences for humanity due to climate change, but that there's a imminent, like our kids and grandkids are going to die out of a climate catastrophe if we don't stop growing. Okay, so I think that's the part that I think is absolutely wrong. And I don't think there's a single piece of scientific evidence that I've heard ever that's saying that humanity in its totality will go extinct in the lapse of 50 years or 25 years. if we don't stop climate change. I think that's an exaggeration. And I think a lot of people who, so to be clear, Jason Hixel doesn't make this claim on his blog post, but I've heard this from other degrowers and people that I've talked in front of too. And I think this is dishonest and it's just untrue either. So I guess that why do I say that diagnosis is wrong is because I do think that we have, this is a fancy word economists use, right? We have some policy space. So we have some space to figure out what are these the most appropriate response to climate change that will both minimize or mitigate the consequences of climate change while also not decreasing standards of living or not being as costly to humankind. The more time we don't do anything, and also to be super clear, I do think that we're not doing enough, and I think that we need urgent action to change the current course of climate change. So the more time we take, I think the more likely it is that we're going to have to contemplate more radical proposals. And I would be even open to a slowing down of, you know, cutting 1% of GDP growth of the West on the US, which I think that's something actually you could be able to do as opposed to halting growth totally in all the world. But yeah, so just to make it super clear, what I think that the part of the diagnosis is wrong is about the speed and the gravity of the climate catastrophe. Okay, it is. I don't think it is true that our children are gonna die on a massive scale, all of them. Humanity is not gonna go extinct in 20 years if we don't do anything in climate change. I think that's completely false and bogus.
My understanding of the climate science, and yeah, not of whatever claims that like people who are pro degrowth are making, but like my understanding of the climate science is not that there's evidence, not necessarily that humans will go extinct within the next generation, but that within the next couple of decades, we will hit some point of no return, that even if we reverse course after that, it will still, there will still be catastrophic consequences in that like 100 to like a couple hundred of years timeline, but that the like point when we can avert that is much nearer.
So I think that this is where, and this is going to sound cold, right? But this is a difficult policy question. So we have to make cold assessments. What does it mean to have catastrophic consequences versus what would degrowth actually impose, right? So we're going to, so just to make a comparison, all right? So, and this is a point we can get on later. And this relates to my second point, which is degrowth would have disastrous consequences for the vast majority of workers, right? So suppose that we take strong degrowth at face value, we stop GDP growth right now for everyone in the world, right? That would mean that we're condemning, based on, you know, current calculations of poverty statistics around the world, that we're condemning 15% of the world to earn $2 per day and 25% of the world to earn $2.5 per day, right? And these dollars are in purchasing power T. So they're in terms of equal purchasing power across the globe and adjusted for exchange rate and so on and so on, okay? So, and that's it. If we stop growth from here forever, 25% of humanity will live with $2.5 per day, all right? Forever, for degrowth to make sense, right? So that's condemning millions of people to the amount of human indignity that is there, I cannot even fathom. And of course, as you guys must expect, this will be concentrated in, you know, Africa, Latin America, actually like the global south, right? Let's take an alternative scenario. Suppose that one doom scenario that I've heard frequently that I'm not denying, right? But let's say in 40 years we melt all of the poles, right? Sea waters level rise, and as a consequence, Florida. I'm in public, so I'm not going to make a welfare statement about whether I'd be happy or not of Florida being drowned. Let's suppose that so Florida goes underwater, the Netherlands too. Okay. And, you know, some other few other kilometers of land. What would this trigger? Well, this would trigger, obviously, excess deaths, mortality, right? Perhaps a few hundred thousand people would die if this, like, it's an unprecedented, if the scale of this is too quickly. I'm more optimistic towards that what this would happen is that actually will be migration. We would see the seawater coming, and then we would have all of the people in Florida migrate, but they would have to abandon their families and so on and so on. So that's a large economic costs. And then, you know, in the case of whole countries, that's very complicated because the political consequences that we could have, for example, in the European Union would be very, very complicated, right? We have to migrate, and then maybe this creates social unrest. And right. So that's one catastrophic scenario, quote unquote. So my question is, well, what's more catastrophic, to have a one-time off migration a crisis of these proportions, or to condemn from here until the end of time to a quarter of humanity to living in some in you know miserable conditions, right? Like so that's I think that's a very tough question to answer, obviously, right? But my kind of my take is that the cure is worse than the disease in the case of degrowth, right? I think that a lot of the even in and again there's uncertainty about a lot of this climate like I've never heard a climate scientist says no with certainty we will reach this tipping point where everyone dies. No, it says well we have a lot of uncertainty. There's a possibility that if we go over this like right, but I'm saying that I you know if we compare that with scenario where we certainly impose degrowth on a lot of people, I think that the degrowth has the more catastrophic consequences. I'm not saying that we're forced to choose between each other. I'm saying that there's a great alternative, which is green growth, right? And that's what I advocate. So I think that the correct alternative is that if we are able, and this is kind of referred to the paper that I picked, if we are able to subsidize clean technologies in the right way, and we're able to take firm but immediate action of hiking up carbon prices. Even just in the United States and the global North, we could transition to a regime where we have both sustained growth and less emissions and, you know, much less climate damage. And we can mitigate a lot of the consequences from climate change even without sacrificing anything in terms of standards of living. And I think that's a much, much more attractive policy proposal than degrowth.
Yeah, I found the paper very, made me sleep slightly better at night thinking like science will find a way. It's all good. I don't need to worry about this. Just technology will solve it. But like Jason Hickel, he posted a bunch of references that say that green growth is not feasible, right? What do you think about that?
I'm not really familiar with his objections.
If I can jump in, because I did homework. So So first of all, if I can say so, like Alejandro is talking about the strong situation of degrowth in this comparison. There's also the like weak form of degrowth, which is like the global south is allowed to continue to develop, and either, you know, GDP in the global north is held constant, or there is like degrowth in the global north. This would be a different scenario to get into that I think more degrowth proponents would support than the strong version of degrowth. But on the current topic, the arguments that I heard in the podcast that I listened to about degrowth that are why green growth is not feasible is that you still require any growth requires resource consumption, and resource consumption requires resource extraction. And this was kind of one of the questions I had about the paper too, is that like green energy, obviously much better than fossil fuels, obviously much cleaner, obviously much better for the environment, but it still requires resource extraction. It requires mining lithium for batteries. It requires, you know, mining and creating all of these chemicals and polymers to, you know, make the windmills. And it requires, you know, developing all of these solar panels, which require lots of rare earth metals. And it's still extractive. And so the argument of why green growth can't happen is that you can't totally decouple growth from extraction. And even if you approach a point at which the earth cannot support the amount of growth that's happening anymore much slower, you will still approach it because you still need to extract in order to grow. This was my understanding. And let me know if that made sense, because it's a very lay person's understanding of this.
No, I think that's an you put it in excellent. I can see where you're the host of this podcast. You put that in lay person's term. So let me reply to that. So, and this is related to the paper where it addresses specifically this concern. So the essential idea is to have GDP, right? To have anything that we want to consume in terms of goods and services as a society, be it, you know, tables and computers and chairs or cars, medical services and teachers, we need to use inputs to produce them, right? And obviously we use a lot of inputs. So some of these inputs are, you know, they're human labor, obviously, the most important human input of all. There's also other intermediate goods that are produced elsewhere. And then there's, you know, some natural resources that are either renewable or non-renewable, right? Think about, we make a list with all the inputs in production, right? So there is a knife edge case where green growth doesn't work. What is this knife edge case? The knife edge cases where two things happen simultaneously. One is where the non-renewable input is essential for production. So that means that you can't go without it. So that means that it's essential for production. It means that it's impossible to substitute. Economics think about a concept which is, you know, kind of how substitutable are different inputs, right? So you can, the way I always explain this to my students, like when I explain production theory, is you can, most economists think that what we call a production function, so something that maps your inputs into GDP, right? It's kind of like a cooking recipe, right? So you're going to make pasta, right? With meatballs. So for that, you know, you make a bunch, you need the raw pasta, you'll need the ground beef, you will need kind of the eggs and so on and so on. And then if you've ever done any cooking, a key, you know, like a lot of people say, well, you know, good cooks always find substitutes, or you can just mess and put a little bit of this instead of that. If you don't have any salt, you just put MSG. And so on, right? Some degrowths think that, you know, the economy is more like baking as opposed to cooking, right? So when you bake, you have to be extremely precise, right? With all the, like the, if you go over a little bit with the flour or with the butter or with the sugar, you know, your dish is going to explode and it's going to be horrible, right? So the kind of the empirical question is, well, is the economy more like having a cooking recipe where it's very easy to substitute, ingredients out and still manage to make a dish that's reasonable? Or is it more like a baking recipe where you have a list of these inputs that you can never substitute, right? So I think what degrowers have in mind is that essentially the economy is like a baking recipe where there's some natural resource that you can never substitute, right? Now, obviously, this is an empirical question, right? So what does, you know, data on production and input say? So let me tell you two things. One, a historical experience to illuminate, make it this more colorful. And then the other one, you know, we can go like into the actual raw numbers and data. So as I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, I'm from Chile, right? And before we made our living exporting copper, which is a natural resource that you extract, right? And it's non-renewable. We made our living between, you know, all of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century exporting nitrate, right? So nitrate was, we had like huge mines of nitrate. Nitrate was called the salary of Chile. And, you know, 60% of our exports were nitrate. And that was we were the main player in the world economy for that. And, you know, nitrate was used at the time we exported it as an agricultural input, right? To grow woods. Now, there's a little event that happened in the beginning of the 20th century called World War I, this is why it's important to not underestimate market forces and the needs of the production kind of structure. Because what the Germans figured out is that, you know, nitrate was also really good to put to make, you know, gunpowder and, you know, put it on your arms. And that actually relying on a country all over across the world who had doubtful political allegiances to them was, you know, not so great in the middle of a large-scale war effort. So what did they do? They said they invented synthetic nitrate. And in a few years, in less than 10 years, synthetic nitrate, which is renewable, essentially eclipsed nitrate. And the Chilean economy entered like a very deep crisis until we figured out, you know, we should do copper. Right. So hopefully what this illustrates is that there are many, many large scale cases where humanity has been used an input, right, that at some point people deemed essential, like nitrate, that, like you said, Jamie, you have to extract, right, to have agricultural production and so on. And then through innovation and technology, sometimes very directed, and that's the theme of the paper, it's not the mysterious market forces, not with very deliberate state action and intervention, we have been able to invite a synthetic renewable version of this resource, right? And we could list like many, you know, non-renewable resources that have over time been substituted. So that's kind of, hopefully this illustrates my argument. But what the data says, based on like my reading of the evidence in environmental ecologics, is that there are very, very few essential inputs, right? So like if all the copper mines in the world were to run out, what would be like the consequences? Let's forget about the environment. Let's just care about the consequences in terms of like what we can produce. You know, that we would be very capable of developing substitutes. Would the goods be of lesser quality and their price higher because the this other input is, you know, it has a higher price? Yes, of course. I'm not claiming that it's not. But I think that you have to have a very... I think this is why a lot of the growers are ecologists and not economists, is because I don't think that once you have an understanding of the ability of inputs to be substituted away through the creation of newer inputs, then you very easily run away from this doomsday scenario, and then you can have growth without extraction, right? So that's kind of the key there. That in the long run, if we give technology the right incentives, then we can develop a bunch of either, you know, non-dirty technologies or technologies that are renewable and not exhaustible that will allow us to grow forever without running into a bottleneck of resources. The only case in which this cannot happen is if there's some sort of essential extractable resource, right? That we always need to produce kind of everything, and we can never substitute away. And I'm not convinced that that's the case. I don't think we have a single piece of empirical evidence that's the case.
I just want to sum up in how I'm processing this in my brain to make sure that I'm like tracking right. So what we're saying is that an argument of people who are pro-degrowth is that green growth is not reasonable because in order to make things, you can't just pull them out of the ether. You have to use other things to make those things. And so you have to use up non-renewable resources in order to create the things that are going to make green growth possible. And so this is why they don't think that that is, you know, an accessible avenue. And what you're saying is that, you know, the ingredients to make all of the green technology is not set in stone. It's not a recipe that can never be changed, you know, when something runs out or, you know, if something happens, you know, a disaster and we lose access to this resource, that, you know, from your historical example, and I'm sure many hundreds of other examples, humans have been running into issues and figuring out how to skirt those issues since there have been humans. So the issue of we'll run out of these ingredients to make these things in order to make green growth happen is null, because we can find substitutes and we can make synthetic versions of things and we can adapt even if we run into issues that make it so that this isn't, you know, as tenable as it used to be.
Absolutely. That is exactly my argument.
Okay.
And so, yeah, my question was about a term that I found in Acemoglu's paper, which I think is what refers to what you're talking about, which is elasticity of substitution.
Yeah,
is that kind of what you're talking about?
Exactly. So in technical non-layman's terms, the elasticity of substitution refers to, you know, kind of how much an input input A varies in percentage terms when you vary input B, conditional on keeping the level of output the same, right? So the thought experiment is like, what percentage of salt should I put in if I take out one percentage point of MSG to keep having my fried rice be delicious, right? So that's kind of the thought experiment. So then that there are two kind of polar cases. One is, you know, zero. When the elasticity of substitution is zero, then you're screwed, right? If you take out the MSG, then, you know, your fried rice just will not be delicious and no amount of salt can. And that's like the essential input case, right? That's the case the growers have in mind. But that's a knife edge condition. If the elasticity of substitution is positive, it's not zero, then there always exists, and that's the point of view, the technical stuff, but there always exists a growth path, right? Where you can transition into a green technology, you know, kind of without sacrificing our welfare and well-being.
Gotcha. So if I run out of milk, half and half is highly elastic. I can just water it down and that's all good.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's the idea.
I think that maybe some people who are, you know, arguing for, you know, green growth isn't possible because of these reasons are underestimating human ingenuity and underestimating how, if we really want a cake, we'll figure out how to do it.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Evelyn. Let me just say one thing, which is I think another interesting point of the paper, because one would say, well, how do we know that we will make the right innovations, right? The right substitutions, right? How do we know that we will, are there any forces, societal forces that will push us towards creating inputs that are renewable and substitute out inputs that are not renewable or exhaustible resources, right? So there, and this is like the kind of right wing response to climate change, which will be, well, the market will take care of it. And how? Well, the argument is as follows. If you, as the exhaustible resources become more and more scarce, their price will go up, right? Because there will be equal or greater demand for those exhaustible resources, but there are each time less and less amounts of them available in nature. So as the prices go up, this sends the right signals to capitalists who use these inputs as intermediate inputs in their production and say, well, you know, now the price of copper has gone up 10 times in the past, you know, 10 years. And hence, you know, it would really pay off if we had someone in our R&D department to figure out a synthetic input that doesn't use copper, because then it would save us a lot of money, right? So then the argument goes, you know, the free market, if it internalizes the price, the price signals correctly, it would just, it would, you know, we would just always create the renewable resources. And, you know, that would, we would kind of automatically face off climate change. Now, I think this argument, there's certainly evidence that capitalists try to maximize their profits, and hence they try to cheapen out their labor inputs. But I also think, one, as I just mentioned in the case of Chile, there are many, you know, cases where we develop synthetic versions or renewable versions of inputs, not based on market mechanisms, but based on state action. And then two, and this is a point of Acemoglu's paper, is that the speed at which the market substitutes could be low enough, right? That while the market is finding a clean technology, we are polluting more than what is socially desirable, and the climate consequences are more than what is socially desirable. And that's actually Acemoglu's argument. So Acemoglu's argument is says something along the lines of, everyone uses carbon, so there's a market size effect, right? Like everybody demands carbon, so there are a lot of incentives to create intermediate inputs which use carbon, right? Whereas if there's nobody right now, there's not a market for green technology, then that makes it very difficult to demand the green technology. So this is what's called in economics an externality. An externality is when, you know, the prices of the market don't fully reflect the social value of things, right? So pollution obviously is a classic example. When a company goes and pollutes, right, it doesn't have to pay the cost for pollution, but everybody suffers because of their pollution. So that's, you know, one of the main reasons why you want to have carbon taxes. But Acemoglu's argument is a little bit different. What he's saying is that there's a market size externality, right? When you as an inventor face a very large potential market, there is an incentive to develop technologies that will ease that market, and the rate of expansion or invention will be higher the higher this market size effect. So he's saying we're locked in a position where we have been developing dirty technologies using carbon because that's what the market size for that is so big, and that's why we need subsidies and we need a push for clean technology to come in, because if not, the market will take a long, long time, right? That this market size effects will offset the tendency of the price of dirty technologies to rise due to the exhaustion of natural resources, right? And that's why we need to tax the shit out of carbon, and we need to subsidize clean energies, right? In an attempt to reach an ecological transition where we have subsidized kind of clean technologies at a rate higher enough that we can keep on green technical progress going. So his call is for, you know, immediate action. And he doesn't think that the market is going to resolve things by itself, right? He thinks that it needs the right incentives. And I very much agree with that. So yeah, but I don't know. Are you persuaded, Jamie, that green growth is feasible, or do you have some sort of prior that, you know, there's always some sort of technology that we can't substitute away from?
I think for me, I was trying to go through the thought experiment of like, okay, we've created a synthetic substitute. Like the materials for that still need, like you can go down and down and down. Like you need materials for things, and we can sort of imagine a case where we, you know, maximally substitute renewable materials for non-renewable materials. And it is difficult for me to imagine a case where we can fully substitute, like everything is renewable. We, you know, take nothing that cannot be replaced and, you know, do nothing that will pollute. And perhaps this is a failure of my imagination, but, you know, I was going to say as a rebuttal, well, go one step back. How do you make that synthetic nitrate? Go one step back. How do you make those inputs, et cetera? In my thinking, you can't just say like, oh, we can substitute something that is, you know, renewable or not extracted from something that is extracted, because you need to produce the things that produce that. And you need to make that in a lab which uses, you know, disposable things, which will, well, then maybe you can make things that are, you know, biodegradable. So you dispose of your lab gown and it degrades. Well, then how do you make that? And where do you take the materials for that from?
Right. But I think the claim is not that suddenly we will stop kind of using exhaustible or non-renewable resources or altogether and, you know, everything's going to be green. I think that the claim is that to keep your rate of growth, you can decrease the rate of extraction of natural resources if you're compensating the decrease in the rate of extraction by increasing the rate at which you create new technologies that require a lesser rate of extraction, right? So I think that's the argument. At least over a couple hundred of years, you know, you can imagine a situation where that kind of goes on. I think that a key example with this is land, right? So a lot of the finite resources in an infinite plan goes back to, as I mentioned at the beginning, the work of Malthus, right? So Malthus was an English economist in the 19th century, which essentially said the following, said population growth is exponential, right? Meaning, you know, it increased in a geometric fashion. It was the good old days when everyone wanted to have kids. Not right now. We would argue that that's not the case anymore. And then he said, well, but the rate of extraction of land is arithmetic, right? So you will put one more person, you extract one more bushel of grain, right? So he said, well, essentially, we will go to a situation where population overpopulation will saturate the demand for food and agricultural production will not be able to keep up with population growth. And then he didn't think that, you know, we were going to run out of land. He was more worried, like, everyone's going to die because of lack of food and food prices are going to be high. And you do find there's a lot of evidence for this, like, Malthusian cycles pre-industrial revolution, where when population growth too high, there were pressures on the prices of food and, you know, population growth decreased. But after the industrial revolution, I think, you know, Malthus has been proven extremely wrong. Why? Because, and I think this goes back to your earlier point, Evelyn, that he underestimated human ingenuity and the ability to increase the productivity of agriculture. So if you plot every chart of like agricultural productivity versus the growth rate of population, agricultural productivity has gone through the roof. It has gone through the roof so much that the average, the average amount of disposal of food in the United Kingdom is like 6 kilos of food per week. You know, people are throwing away food in Malthus' home country because they can't, you know, they can't eat enough of it. While population has increased, I would have to look up, but I bet you at least like tenfold since the days of Malthus. So I guess what I'm saying is I am not claiming that I can see your point, Jamie, that you at the end of the day, you kind of always, you know, I'm a socialist, so I tend to think that labor is the only essential factor in production. We could do away with that I feel pretty sure. I don't think there's a future where robots completely displace us, for example. That's a topic conversation for another day. But my point is, like, if you use less and less exhaustible and dirty resources, right, the rate of extraction can go down and the growth rate can still keep as it is, as long as, you know, we create better intermediate inputs, which are renewable and are green. And this situation could go on for a couple hundreds of years. I don't think there's any evidence for a scenario where you stop growing now or copper is going to run out tomorrow and we kind of die in 25 years. That's kind of my position.
Right. So to kind of summarize that, then the position of green growth is not zero extraction and not like complete decoupling of growth from extraction, but that the rate of extraction can go down such that it is sustainable over a I would say a couple hundred years is maybe a medium term, right? And we will obviously continue to innovate as a species because that is one of the things that we do. But that in the medium term, the rate we can bring the rate of extraction down to levels which are sustainable, given continued growth at some level. And, you know, you even said you would potentially support some reduced level.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there can be a transition where we consume less. Are the commerce persuaded or are they not persuaded?
Yeah, so the thing is, like, I read Acemoglu's paper and the model seems incredibly sophisticated. But at the end of the day, to me, it's just like, this is just a model. How do you know that this works? Like, what is the empirical evidence that this is modeling what it should model correctly? And that's my main qualm with everything. I'm like, it's just theory, right? So what makes you believe that the model is going to predict things correctly?
That's a fair point. I think that innovative, radical policy proposals are always a little bit theory and a little bit imagination and drip and a leap of faith. And because I've always been into politics, I've always been said, like, we shouldn't be afraid of, you know, letting our political imagination kind of run wild and you know, do something, for example, like Acemoglu's, you know, like we put AOC in power in 10 years and we managed like an aggressive system of subsidies and carbon taxes in the North. And I think, and you know, the question is, well, will this work or not? Well, the policies will have their intended effect. Whenever we're addressing policies that have never been tried before by humankind, there's always that big uncertainty, right? So let me say that. However, this is not to dismiss your question, obviously. I think you are saying, well, what's kind of the empirical evidence for, or I will, let me interpret your question. What is the empirical evidence for some of the core mechanisms that Acemoglu kind of is thinking about in his paper, right? So I think a big part of this paper, it's an application to some of his earlier work on directed technical change, right? So the idea of directed technical change is that firms can pick the direction of technical change, meaning they can choose to spend R&D resources in technologies that augment the productivity of one input over the other, right? So that's kind of the idea. So think about a company. Well, we can think of this at the aggregate level of the economy. We pick certain technologies that increase the productivity of labor, right? Or sometimes increase the productivity of capital and replaces labor, right? We see that with robots and so on, right? So a lot of his earlier work was on this idea of the market size effect, right? So the idea is, well, companies will choose to direct technical change in the direction where the market is the biggest, right? Which seems very intuitive when you think about it, and you're like, wow, how did an economist figure that out? You know, a lot of like discussion in economics, sometimes economists have an obsession with prices, right? So what that the prices will do, and not sometimes they ignore quantities or scale kind of effects. So Acemoglu is really talking about a scale effect, right? So he's thinking like the larger the size of the market, the more profitable are an innovation. And he lays out where the technical conditions for that to happen in kind of in his earlier work. Now, is there any empirical evidence that research incentives respond to market size effects? And yeah, there are a bunch of papers that, you know, he kind of goes over some of them. One of his big examples is diabetes, right? So kind of type 2 diabetes. Americans love diabetes. And they're also a very big nation. So, you know, kind of the market size for diabetes is kind of disproportionately big compared to other kind of other pharmaceutical products. And there's a paper that he quotes that, you know, you see a lot of like research effort put into diabetes compared to other diseases. And I think there's a good deal of empirical evidence for that. Another case which is, you know, kind of, again, very salient, it's COVID, right? So, I mean, COVID was a global disease, right, that had a certain mortality rate and it was expanded very rapidly. Because it affected the whole world, we saw an unprecedented speed, right, at which it was profitable for companies to go on and develop a vaccine. And you know, I remember a lot of people were skeptics and say where there's the pandemic, whatever, whatever, because how fast the vaccine rollout. And what these, you know, people didn't understand is, well, one, they didn't understand that a lot of the important parts of vaccine production testing come up in the logistical phase, and that's why that's the part that you can like speed up, not necessarily like the testing, but it's because there was a huge market size effect, right, at that moment. And one thing I remember reading a newspaper article about this that I don't quite find right now, but in Latin America there are many, you know, diseases that have no vaccines that have higher mortality rate and higher transmission rate than COVID, that have been there stuck for decades and decades. So why don't pharmaceuticals go and develop that vaccine? Is it because they're evil and they just don't care about the lives in the global south? No, it's because there's the market size effect, right? Like the populations that are affected by this are small enough where these there's an under provision, right, of pharmaceutical research or vaccine research in that area. You know, and that's where kind of there's a role for the state to come in and correct this. So I do think that there's plenty of evidence for this market size effect. I am very sympathetic towards it. And that's one of the key building blocks of this model. In many ways, this model is just like an application of this market size effect to an environment where you have two technologies, a dirty technology and a clean technology. And there's a market size effect favoring the dirty technology, right? So that's the intuition. And that's why there's an over-provision of this dirty technology. So of course, you could still reply like, well, Alejandro, but you know, the fact that there's evidence for this in the pharmaceutical markets does not mean that there's evidence for this in the energy markets. There might be other distortions and so on. And true, I agree with that. But I do think that there's more and more evidence piling up about this market size effect where I think it's a relevant mechanism, and it's there's enough empirical evidence where I think it's a subtle like foundation for this modeling block.
On the comment of, you know, is everybody convinced about it? Persuaded, don't know if that's the correct word. Do I understand the path of logic so far? Yes, which is what's important to me right now. In order to have an opinion of my own on it, we're halfway through the explanation. And so the Excel spreadsheet of my opinion is still collecting input. I don't have an output yet. So what do I think about everything? I will not be able to give a good explanation of my thought process until I have the whole picture of what we're talking about. And then when all the inputs are in, I can run the process and have my output.
Now that's fair. That's completely fair. So to recap, we talked about the strong version of degrowth where it's like everyone stops growing, right? And then there's the subversion of degrowth where we allow, you know, people in the lesser parts of the world catch up, right, to the income of the developed nations. So what I want to say is that first that would actually entail quite a bit of growth in terms of global GDP. How much global GDP would have to rise more or less 2.7 times. So that would be 170% growth over the span of, I don't know, like 25 years, maybe, you know, that's being optimistic. So that's quite a bit. So if you really think that if we double GDP, right, so which means we keep growing at 2%, all the world keeps growing at 2% except for developed nations for like 25 years, then this is not a solution to your own diagnostic. But okay, let's suppose that this is somehow solves the issues. So, you know, Branko kind of discusses some of these, puts kind of some numbers of this. Says, well, what if we allow the developing world to reach $14,600 US dollars per year? So that's the median income in the developed world of the 1995 percentile. So, you know, a lot of people in the degrowth, Jason doesn't do this, but I've seen a lot of people that say, well, you know, we stopped growing, but we still have this problem of huge income inequality. What if we do like a radical redistribution, right, of income? So then we kind of force everyone to get an income in the developing world of $14,600 USD, right? And there's some mechanism that allows us to do that. Or even better yet, instead of having people in the poor countries grow, we transfer resources from the north to the south, right? So I just want to make two comments on that. One is that 14,600 is, as hopefully everyone here agrees, it's extremely low, right? Extremely low. Like our graduate student stipends, it's like 30, 35K per year. We want to fight to get to 40K, right? Can you, so Can you imagine if I would, you know, we elect a union and then we have to go, guys, we're now going to support the growth. We're going to cut our incomes in half, right? The United Auto Workers just won pay increases that would allow them to have like 60 to 70K per year. So would, I mean, does this mean that we go to workers in the auto industry and say, well, you know, now we want your support for degrowth and ecological transition. You would have to cut your incomes by five. Is that correct? Can the mathematician help me out? 30, no, by four, 4 point something, right? So, I mean, so we were talking off screen about sometimes, you know, people accusing of degrowth of being uncharitable accusations of being like a dictator. But I mean, I don't think Reagan or Thatcher or Pinochet in their wildest dreams could ever have, you know, imagine reducing the incomes of working of workers in the respective countries or around the world to those levels, right? And degrowth is kind of exacting, does exactly what it claims to want to do if you want this radical redistribution. And that ties in of why I don't think there would be any political support for this, because it will be impossible to sell to, you know, workers and the popular classes around the developed world that they have to cut their income so much.
So I think I found a counter argument in Hickel's posts here, and he claims that, you know, a lot of the income, for instance, in the United States is wasted, right? Because you have private health insurance and whatnot. You don't have good public transportation in most of cities, and to just quote him here, he says here, in theory, we could achieve all our social goals for every person in the world with much less GDP than we presently have, simply by investing in public goods and distributing income and opportunity more fairly, right? So, and underlining there, investing in public goods. So it seems that, you know, sure, if you just cut everybody's income in half immediately, it would be catastrophic. But what if you did this kind of transition into more like, hey, maybe don't buy so many books. Let's invest in a library or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, so this is kind of what we said, the things that are new versus not new in growth, because I think that, you know, socializing resources and having the state provide public goods and have some sort of planning and to put correct incentives that, you know, we have more public transport and less yachts has always been part of the socialist agenda, right? And I am fully sympathetic to that. I mean, please let politicians across the U.S. hear you and fix the goddamn public transport in their cities, which is horrible, right? So I totally agree with you, right? I mean, if we were to redirect confiscate a bunch of every, you know, second car in a household, right? And I don't know, cut income that way and then put all of that money into public transport, I think that would increase welfare, yeah, even if people would have to get used to like the commodity of not having a car and you know, it is because of population density and so on, the social return of having transport is a little bit lower in the US than it is, let's say, China. But I'm fully sympathetic to that. But my point is that this is a strategic reallocation of resources across certain sectors. And I would argue that to do that effectively, you would probably need growth, right? Because during this transition where you reallocate resources, there will be a lot of experimentation, a lot of ways to figure out if we're doing things the right or the wrong way. So we would argue that we probably need some, you know, kind of additional resources to have the political and economic imagination to implement these ideas in, for example, in the United States, right? So like how would it, I think that's a very challenging question. You know, how do you build up a public transit system that covers, a national public transit system that covers all of the, you know, United States? That's incredibly challenging. I mean, it's a huge continent with low population density. You know, there's a reason why trains are not so popular as they could be in China. So you probably, there will be wasting while you figure that out and you adopt and you create technology that's more important for local conditions. And doing that while you're growing versus degrowing seems better for me, unless you want, you know, the public to go kind of against you. I would say the targeted reallocation of resources, it's a problem of allocation of resources, not a problem of growth per se, right? And under provision of public goods, it's a problem of under provision of public goods. This is all kind of old news in socialist circles and economics. Is not a problem of growth per se. Could you, with the provision of these public resources and reallocation, actually increase welfare? while decreasing, you know, the total amount of labor input or GDP that you need. Yeah, I'm super sympathetic towards that. I think that's the case. But that's a problem for allocation of resources, not of growth per se.
Wouldn't that functionally, so this was going to be my question, is like after some transition period, right, where we specifically allocate resources and funding and, you know, grow the public transit industries and we, you know, publicize healthcare so that we don't have all of these insurance companies like taking up so much financial bloat in the healthcare system and do all of these things that we all agree is good, right? Ultimately, could that lead to a situation where we have, you know, the same or higher welfare and lower GDP, and thus this would be degrowth, but just like after a period of like reallocation of resources and some growth in the meantime.
Right. I mean, I don't think so. I mean, I think if the thought experiment supposed that we have like a static economy, somehow we pause growth and we do all of these reallocations, right? And we have less GDP, more leisure time, right? I think that's possible. But I think that the reallocation in terms of GDP wouldn't be that big. I mean, I think maybe it would be 5% lower or 10% lower, right? That's a kind of like a one-shot experiment, right? When we're talking about economic growth, we're talking about growing, for example, the current growth in the U.S. post-war period, 2.5%. You know, that you would recover all of that in 4 years. If we think that the loss of GDP through these reallocation channels is like 10%. Which I think is on the high end. So if you think about, well, you know, we want to keep growing for 50 years, right? For two more generations, right? 2.5. Here, the mathematician can help me out of what's that to the power of 50. If we were to grow 2.5% for 50 years, if my back of the envelope calculations are right, we would, you know, GDP would increase by a factor of 2.4, right? That's much more than I think any static losses from this reallocation of resources, right? Which I think could happen. But I also want to say that, you know, maybe they could happen in the US, but could they happen in, which is notorious, and I hope I'm not insulting Evelyn or Jamie, which is like notoriously dysfunctional in the way it kind of funds public programs and in the size of its welfare state, right? So that's, but do we think the same about Norway? Do we think the same about France? You know, maybe the ability to redistribute. I mean, you know, the Scandinavian countries already have the shortest work week of the whole planet. And they already have, you know, a big welfare state that, you know, has a lot of socialized. How more do we think we could socialize and how much less kind of working week could we have due to, you know, being an under provision of public goods and so on? I'm not entirely sure. I think the correct thought experiment is what you're saying is, I don't know, Europeans work 15% less than, I think is kind of bigger than America's, right? So if we wanted to work 15% less and have a social state, the social welfare state the size of Europe, maybe that drops GDP in, you know, 10 percentage points and it closes the gap in living standards between Western Europe and the US. But I don't know how much more space for this there is in already heavily social democratic economies, which ironically is where one of the places where, you know, degrowers come from the most. I mean, a lot of this is, you know, British and French guys and, you know, and some Germans. But it's not as popular in the US. That would be my answer, Jamie. I don't know if you're satisfied with that.
I think it leads me to perhaps a very silly question, but this is in plain English. And so I'm going to ask it is I'm leaving aside the case of the Global South. I think it's quite obvious why we need to have growth in the Global South. Why do we need growth?
So I think that's a good question. And sometimes this is, so I think that the short answer for this, because we wanna, and this is going to piece off William maybe, but hopefully I can defend this, which is, you know, growth is, or GDP is useful to the extent that we consume it, right? So that would be to have, enjoy a higher consumption, right? So the first thing I want to say before I get, you know, rocks thrown at me is that aggregate consumption in the U.S. composed of a lot of, you know, components. It's not, I mean, when you say consumption or sometimes you hear careers of consumerism, you're thinking, oh, so, you know, couldn't we be better off without the last, iPad or the last, a person very close to me just gifted me this the latest Sony headphones for listening to music, which are fantastic. So like, couldn't you do it without that and buy, you know, a $20 headset? Or and I like, I get that, but a lot of consumption also means bigger houses. It means having, you know, a garden, or, you know, it means have a, you know, access to medical service. Even leaving aside the fact that, you know, that's actually one salient fact about the U.S. that a lot of people spend a lot of money in public health. It's not, sorry, not in public, but in just in health expenditures. And that's not because the health system in the United States is like the best across the board. It's because of social insurance and so on and so on. But growth is what allows us, you know, doctors to have better labs, right? And to have more medical personnel and so on and so on. You know, educational services, right? Like are also part of, from the point of view of national accounts, right? They're counted as consumption of kind of educational service. So I do think that, I don't know, I've always joined socialism because I thought socialism promises a life of abundance to the many as opposed to the few, right? So that life of abundance means, and richness means in some sense, consumption. Now, is growth or consumption the only index of like economic welfare that we could come up with? Definitely not. Of course not, right? Life expectancy, which is, you know, down in the U.S. because of all these deaths of despair, is, you know, incredibly important. Our leisure time, the average working week, is incredibly important. Inequality, right, is also incredibly important, right? You could argue, some people have, and I'm sympathetic to this argument, that, you know, literacy and education itself are also like welfare improving because they allow us to develop our human capabilities. So if you ask me, so if Willem came to me, it's like, hey, but wouldn't you be willing to sacrifice some GDP or some consumption, especially in the United States, to have, you know, a more egalitarian society, to live longer, to rest more? I would be 100% sympathetic for that. Absolutely. And I do think that, you know, we socialists can do a better job at putting the policy emphasis in those things. But I don't think that I also don't think it's socially desirable to grow zero. I mean, if we grow zero from here to the future, right now we see as a luxury things like the internet, or even going back, like, you know, telephones or, you know, cars. But now they seem like essential, right? In terms of the amounts of costs that we save up to communicate with each other, to transport to other places, and so on. And these are a result in large part of economic growth, right? So I think my more nuanced response is why we think growth, because they're one important ingredient in increasing standards of living, even if they're not the only ingredient, then that we should emphasize other things in the policy debate. And sometimes people can have an unhealthy obsession with growth. I'm totally sympathetic with that. But an unhealthy obsession with not growing is equally bad or worse, I think so.
I agree 100% with that. I mean, there's like first world problems and developing world problems, right? And I think, you know, when you haven't have your basic human needs met, you know, because your economy is not sufficiently robust, that is a priority, you know. And I think for me, being sort of like a socialist and a leftist, it's also a matter of perspective, of always considering the people who are marginalized first, which is why I think, you know, in the blog debate, I think Milanovic, he kind of touches a bit on that. Like, what are the implications for the developing world? Think about those people who are more fragilized and more marginalized first, before necessarily maybe feeling guilty about how much you consume in the first world, you know. So I agree 100% that, you know, I think it's a bit of a nonlinear problem. You know, you need some growth at a certain aspect, you know, in a certain point of your country's development, but then after a while it might become superfluous and redundant, you know.
I don't know, something in the argument of, you know, whether degrowth is a good idea or not, especially when people in the global north, in the States, in the Western world, are talking about these ideas and these concepts. I guess I shouldn't make broad statements about everybody. I can just speak for myself as somebody who grew up in a relatively wealthy and well-off nation, in an environment, you know, my family wasn't wealthy necessarily. We probably weren't even middle class. We grew up on the edge of the struggle to survive, but not like deep in the hole of the work that it would take to get to the point where all of your basic needs are met and you can think about things like ideas and art and, you know, all of these things. I have no direct personal experience with that world. So even though I know it exists, even though I can try to imagine what that might be like, you know, having this discussion surrounded by people who are like me, who don't know what it feels like to be so deep in the survival debt of, you know, really underdeveloped areas of the world where all of your energy that you can make every single day is spent on figuring out how you're going to make it to the next day. You don't have any more mental battery, you know, a physical battery to think about how you're going to make the next 20, 30 years of your life efficient or successful or productive or any of these things. Your brain is just occupied in how am I going to live until tomorrow? Am I going to take care of the people that are important to me, my children, my family, my aging parents, you know, all this kind of stuff. Because I don't have like direct proximity and I've never like watched these things unfold and I've never experienced them personally. I think that it's kind of a little bit similar to the concept of when we're talking about racism. I have never been a Black person. I've never been a minority. I can try to sympathize and try to think about what that might feel like, but I will never, ever have direct experience with that. And that's the same thing as, you know, me as somebody who grew up in a wealthy nation, trying to have a conversation about an economic idea that affects the entire world. I haven't lived anywhere in the global South. I don't understand viscerally what that is like. So, you know, while I may be able to learn about it and think about it and develop an opinion of it, I think that my opinion on it matters less than an opinion of somebody who does have direct experience with that, I think is what I'm trying to get at. That's an important aspect to consider, is that if you're having this conversation from where I'm standing, it's only a very small facet of, you know, everything that there is to process about this concept. You really need to, you know, hear the opinions of other people, listen to other people that have lived very different experiences from you to get a more comprehensive picture to develop a better opinion about it.
One of the podcasts I listened to for my homework was a podcast called The Fire These Times. So they did a podcast episode on the moral necessity of degrowth. There are three hosts, I believe, and they're all from the Global South. One of them is from Lebanon, and I don't remember where the other two are from off the top of my head. So I think it would be interesting listening. I'll probably put it in the show notes, and I'll also send it directly to you all, because it would provide that perspective of like a pro-degrowth perspective of people who are currently living in the Global South, and so who are making arguments that are like grounded in that lived experience. So I think that'll be interesting, at the very least. It's so hard to think of a wrap-up question for such a large topic. I think probably the best one would be to return to the question from a couple minutes ago, which is like, what do we think? Are we convinced? To what extent? What kinds of information would we need to like better come to an understanding of degrowth as a policy proposal and whether or not it's a good idea?
I'm not entirely convinced. Like I said, I think most of the good ideas have been like just stolen from old school socialism, you know, and I just like hearing people say it, you know, but, you know, in terms of actual policy, things like, you know, stopping economic growth right now, you know, I think that I'm not convinced that would work. That's feasible. That seems, you know, I don't know. I'm not quite sure how to answer. I'm still processing everything. Let's just say, let's just leave it at that.
I think in like kind of an analogy for how I see, you know, just learning about this is that, so if, you know, climate consequences, economic inequality, you know, and those issues are an illness, and the purpose of processing whether degrowth is a good idea or not is this going to fix the issues that we believe are happening? And it's like saying, you know, okay, here's a person with a cold. Should they use more Sudafed or less Sudafed? It's a, how do you answer that question? Only given yes or no options. Is this a good idea? Is this a bad idea? Because there are thousands of other options of how we deal with this. And is the argument Sudafed or no Sudafed? Or is the argument, how do we deal with the cold the best way that we can with the resources that we have access to? So in hearing the pros and cons and the arguments of different people around this concept, I think some people have done a better job of focusing on the issue. And some people have kind of gotten lost in the, do you agree with this or don't agree with this one particular thing? In just, you know, broadly, in thinking about this issue, the point of processing it is, we have issues. How do we fix them? Here's an aspect of that conversation. So what I think so far is that there are a lot of points that Alejandro has made that I 100% agree with. There are some points that, you know, pro-degrowth arguments have made that I agree with. I think that the answer is a lot more complex than, is this a good idea or not a good idea? I think that just like the regular world, there are no simple answers. You know, the reality is a giant matrix of interacting points in 3D space. And so processing the information in order to get the best answers that we can get is not a simple, yay, do this, don't do this.
Yeah, I mean, I think putting it that way resonates with me. And I think what I was going to say is that, like, one thing that I did strongly come away from this reading and discussion with is that there are actually quite a few policy proposals that, you know, pro-degrowth and anti-degrowth people agree upon. All of those, like, you know, redistributive policy proposals, increasing public goods, all of these things, like, seem to be points of agreement. And so, you know, we can, to the best of our abilities and at the scales that we can all act on and influence, we can all move towards those policy proposals. And again, kind of like I said at the beginning, degrowth, from what I understand, is kind of necessarily can't happen in the framework of capitalism. So we can talk about it and theorize about it, understanding that we have a whole lot of work to do that we all agree on first.
No, of course. And I do think that's, you know, also what something that I perhaps didn't emphasize, but I do think a lot of the policy proposals that are on the Acemoglu paper, but also, you know, the Green New Deal, which is the policy proposal of DSA, my own political home, I do think they are feasible within the limits of capitalism, because I don't think we have to wait until a socialist revolution comes to address climate change. That seems nonsense to me. So, no, I'm inspired that you're not like just degrowth, yay, because I think, unfortunately, that's where a lot of other people are going. But I just want to say, Jamie, that I agree with you, and I agree with kind of with William's assessment of the policy, the politics we discussed. But let's just call it socialism. Let's just not call it degrowth. You know, I think that the specific proposal of like stopping degrowth. I think it's such a like idea that will be so widely unpopular with the workers.
This has been wonderful. Thank you all for having this discussion. This has been great.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, this I've loved, even on the points that I don't agree with. I think that almost makes it even more exciting to like hear somebody else's perspective and talk about them. This is great.
Before we go, where can people find you if you want people to find you?
If a stranger walks into my apartment, I will bop you with something. I do not have a website. I have a very weak social media presence. I'm a bit of a hermit. So if you want to find me, make friends with Jamie.
I do have a website. It is gflima.net, because even though I go by William, my name is actually Guilherme Frederico Lima. But no English-speaking person can say that properly. And so, yeah, and there you'll find, like, my emails and stuff I've been doing, you know, stuff I've been writing about many different things, about, like, mathematics, data science, board games, whatnot, you know. And, yeah, that's one way to find me.
Where can you find me? I have a webpage where I have my papers, but also sometimes I write on press. I guess you just Google Alejandro González, economist, and then my website goes up. And I do have a somewhat reasonable Twitter presence, but Twitter's going to hell, I guess. But it's at Alejandro PHC, PH underscore C. So yeah, and I post a lot of my research and, you know, other like policy stuff that I do. And also, if you want to find me here in St. Louis, go to the St. Louis chapter of the DSA. I'm always around for the social events, or I try to be, and I try to be present in the meetings. If you're in St. Louis and you're hearing this and you want to chat in person about the growth, or throw beer in my face because you really like the growth, you can come in person and do that. Just look for Twitter or Google for a St. Louis DSA, and you'll immediately know where to find me.
Absolutely. Well, thank you all once again, and we have been talking about the paper, The Environment and Directed Technical Change by Darren Acemoglu and others, and also blog exchanges between Branko Milanovic and Jason Hickel. Our expert for this episode has been Alejandro Gonzalez, and our two guests have been William Lima and Evelyn Fraser. Our music is by Sam Brunwasser. You can find more of his work at soundcloud.com/visualsnowbeats. As always, you can download the paper and read the transcriptions at inplainenglishpod.org. And make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Plain English Sci. That's PlainEnglishSci. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time for another episode of In Plain English.